Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, it's the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is one of the best guys we ever have on this program, columnist and Albany bureau chief for the New York Daily News, Ken Lovett. Welcome back, Ken.
It's good to be here.
Well, Ken, you're the man of the hour. Everybody's talking about one of the major stories that has hit Albany politics, and that has to do with the Moreland Act Commission. Maybe you could sort of recapitulate your major find, your major story, which, as far as I'm concerned, you deserve a Pulitzer for.
Wow. We found that Governor Cuomo, who had formed this commission to look into corruption and said it would be independent, it can go wherever it wants to go.
Including
his $29 million that he's raised. Turns out, not so much.
Not so much.
Not so much. Apparently, the commission has been meeting privately with the governor, that's chair people, and the governor's people have grabbed control of it and have basically told them not to send out certain subpoenas, including to the Real Estate Board of New York. The commission was looking into this developer deal. There was a bill that passed, a housing bill, and in the middle of this complicated bill, five developers got these really sweet, lucrative tax breaks. So what ends up happening? They subpoena, which they should do, these five developers. However, I then did some stories, this was a few weeks ago, that the governor received boku bucks, a lot of money, from these developers right around the time he was signing the bill. After that, the commission said, we're going to send out a subpoena to the Real Estate Board of New York, which is very close to Andrew Cuomo, and was told by the Cuomo administration, no, don't do that. They were going to send out a subpoena to the state and legislative ethics commissions, you know, J. Cope and the Legislative Ethics Commission, and were told, no, we don't want you to do that. So they didn't do it. And then lastly, it turned out that they did subpoena the state Republican Senate and the state Independence Party. And the reason they were doing that is the Republicans had funneled a lot of money from their campaign account to the Independence Party, which then ran ads in districts that were competitive. So while they were doing this, they said, well, while we're doing this, we should also send a subpoena to the state Democratic Party, which is controlled by the governor and which raised $7 million this year and used most of that money to fund ads promoting the governor's agenda. Well, we don't know if the governor's office was involved in this one. It's assumed it was. But basically, they withheld stopped serving that subpoena. It never went out. And instead, they sent it to the Senate Democrats.
You're a very good reporter, Ken Lovett. How do you find out that the governor, who has appointed an independent commission, said they go where they want to go and we're not going to interfere? How do you find out that they did interfere?
Very good sources. You know,
yeah.
People who want to do the right thing, I guess, is the best thing. Look, the governor had promised, and the truth is the legislature looked at this and had been concerned from the start that this would be a political witch hunt, that the governor would use this to hang things over their heads, and it wouldn't be a real investigation.
So in other words, like people like Shelley Silver and some of the others,
they
say, okay, this guy's going to send this Moreland Act Commission after us, and we don't like that. In fact, they went out and found lawyers because of the separation of powers between the legislature and the governor, and that leads into another whole thing.
And, right? And a lot of people felt that, look, if this commission did the job it was supposed to do and went wherever it wanted to go, that would be a good thing. It would shine a spotlight on what goes on in New York and both the legislative and executive branches. That would be worthwhile, and maybe real change could come out of that. But if it looks like the governor is interfering, and look, you know, he has a penchant, you know, a reputation for wanting to control everything. But by doing it here, I think it severely damaged the credibility of this panel because it played right into the fears of the lawmakers. Another thing that happened, the commission had sent out a letter to the lawmakers saying, we want outside income information from you. For anyone making over $20,000 in private jobs, we want more information.
So a lawyer who is a sitting senator would,
yes,
get this letter saying, you have clients, we want to know where the money is coming from.
Exactly. And basically, the legislature told them, no, we don't recognize your jurisdiction in this issue. We already provide a lot of info in the new reporting we agreed to do a couple of years ago in the first ethics package we agreed to. So we're not going to follow it. So the commission was understandably upset, and a bunch of the commissioner said, why don't we just subpoena the information? And they were told by the governor's office, no, don't do that. I want to negotiate a ethics reform package, so hold off on any subpoenas. It's also been learned that when they sent out the letters to the lawmakers, a big part of the people who were writing it was the governor's counsel, Mylon Dennerstein, that she really was involved in heavily editing that letter. Why? The commission has its own, you know, legal team, its own counsel. Why are they looking to the governor's office and allowing them to write the letter and add in what they want to add in?
Okay, so let me ask you this, Ken Lovett. The Moreland Act Commission, long history in New York State. Tom Dewey and others used these Moreland Act investigatory commissions to root out corruption and to do this kind of thing. And Cuomo says to them, go where the money is, follow the money, and everybody shakes their head. So they appoint two heads, right, for the Moreland Act Commission themselves. Who are the chairs?
Well, three.
Three.
They have the governor's two co-chairs. There's Kathleen Rice, the Nassau County District Attorney, and William Fitzpatrick, who is the Onondaga District Attorney, you know, out in the Syracuse area.
Who's a Republican? Who's a Democrat?
Fitzpatrick is the Republican. Rice is the Democrat. And then you have Milton Williams, I think, who was Eric Schneiderman's pick to be a co-chair.
They make the crucial decisions. Now, I talked to somebody on the Moreland Act Commission who told me, a prosecutor, who told me that the chairs had been very receptive to what some of the very prestigious people on the commission had said to them and made suggestions about where to go. Is that your sense?
Yeah, up until a point. But what I'm told now is, for a while, what had happened was, and the governor was not happy about this, was there was a kind of a split. The governor had appointed a woman named Regina Calcaterra as the executive director. And she was basically seen as doing the governor's bidding, what he wanted to get accomplished, and yada, yada. And apparently, a lot of the commissioners, she rubbed them in the wrong way.
Uh-huh.
Recognizing this, the governor then turned to Fitzpatrick and has been going through him a lot of the time.
Now, he's the Republican.
He's the Republican. And a lot of the stuff that has not gotten done of late, you know, the subpoenas that had not gone out, in large part it went through Fitzpatrick, who stopped it.
Now, I think this gets so complicated, but it's so interesting, at least to me, and that is that the Republicans in New York State are being kept alive in the New York State Senate, I would submit to you, Ken Lovett, by the governor.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's the one who allowed them to draw their own districts, and he's the one who looked the other way while four Democrats broke off and became neo-Republicans during all this. And so the fact that he goes to the Republican on the Moreland Act Commission makes a certain amount of sense. They don't want the rug pulled out from under them.
No, and I guess he was more receptive as well. You know, I can't tell you why. He has a very good relationship with Fitzpatrick. He and Kathleen Rice have an off-and-on kind of relationship. Don't forget,
we've had her here on this very show, and she said she's her own person. She said that to us.
She is, and originally, don't forget, he wanted her to run for attorney general against Eric Schneiderman, and it was believed that he was backing Kathleen Rice, and when her race didn't take off as they thought, they kind of backed off that. But they've had a love, I don't want to say hate, but it's certainly a complicated relationship.
Yeah. Well, she looks like a comer, to be honest with you, and somebody who may play a role in statewide politics as things go on. This is interesting. So now the governor has, I hate to use this word, but plays footsie with the Republican on the Moreland Act Commission. You know, Ken, I don't know how to say this to you, but it seems to me there's always what looks like the upfront idea, like the J. Cope ethics group. Looked like a good idea. They were going to have control over the legislature for the first time. It's going to be a statewide commission. It turns out to be a big flub. He gives away too much. And as my mom said, accidentally on purpose, he gives away their right to appoint all the people, and they don't want to go anywhere, and they don't do anything, and that's what we have. Now he does the same thing with the Moreland Act Commission. It isn't what it seems. It seemed like, go get them, boys. But in fact, no.
No, and I agree. I think he wanted to use this as a hammer to hold over them, to get them to do things, especially heading into an election year. And I think once they started flexing a little independent muscle, they decided to rein it in. But he really, in a lot of people's minds, should have resisted his temptation to control things and let them do their business.
Or not to appoint a Moreland Act Commission at all.
But if you don't want them to be independent, then then don't appoint them. That's the thing. And he didn't like where they were heading. I don't think he liked the fact that they were going to look at some of his donors and some of his big donors. And so he reined them in. I don't necessarily think he thought it would become public, but it did. And I really think it's damaged in a lot of people's eyes the credibility of this commission now, whatever they come out with.
Well, does it hurt the governor is the question.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And now he wants to look at a way to get out of it. You know, we reported that, I think I told you, that at one point they wanted to send subpoenas to the lawmakers who didn't give them the information. And the second floor said, no, don't do it. We want to try and negotiate a deal with these people. I think it's another reason.
What kind of deal? You mean a deal?
An ethics package.
Another ethics package.
And I think that's one of the reasons when they were going to send a subpoena to J. Cope and to the Legislative Ethics Commission, one of the things I'm told they were going to ask for were prior complaints against lawmakers. And I think the lawmakers would have seen that, you know, specifically as an act of war. And I think the governor has been trying to, which is the wrong thing to use this commission for, but I think he's been trying to straddle a line, one where publicly he can say, I'm doing something about corruption. But on the other hand, he didn't want to antagonize the legislature so much. But things started getting out of control. You know, I had a column, I think it was 3 weeks ago, where legislative sources were saying he's jeopardizing his agenda, his legislative agenda next year with this commission. And I think that scared him because the last thing he needs in an election year is a war with the legislature.
I wrote in a recent column that his fiercest enemy now was Shelley Silver. And I heard Letterman just say, without divulging sources, I heard straight and narrow that they were not pleased with my having said that. But I think it's true, isn't it?
Yeah, I think certainly Shelley Silver has been the chief foe, Democrat or Republican, to many a governor in the last two decades. And I don't think Andrew Cuomo's any different. I don't think they will show it publicly necessarily, you know, because they are both Democrats. But I think Shelley Silver, as long as he's in power, which right now he remains in power, although weakened, but I do think that...
I don't know how weakened he is.
But I do think that as long as he's doing what his conference wants, there's not a lot of love in his conference right now for Andrew Cuomo. And as long as he's there, you know, I think that's where it's going to be the hardest. Because, you know, the Democrats are safe. They have a veto-proof majority right now in the Assembly.
Indeed.
The Republicans need the governor because they are not safe. They barely are clinging to power in the Senate. So they are
a lot
more...
No, he's keeping them there. He's keeping them
right.
There.
And so they're a lot more willing to deal than the Assembly Dems might be.
Okay. The best story I have heard in a long time, it's unfortunate because I never like to see people hurt, is the story of Willie or William Rockfogle. And this is an incredible story. I mean, it's the kind of thing when I explain it to people, they say, really? Did that really happen? Tell us about it.
Yeah, for two decades, Willie Rockfogle, who is very close to the Speaker, Sheldon Silver, whose wife is Shelley Silver's chief of staff since really he first became an assemblyman in 76. He had been the head of the Metropolitan Council on Jewish Poverty, a major social services organization in New York City. He has been fired from that job in August and then subsequently charged with being part of a kickback scheme where he pocketed $1 million. They stole $5 million. He worked with an insurance company that had sold policies to the Met Council at inflated prices. So the Met Council would pay the extra costs, and then that money would be divvied up between people involved in the scheme, including Rockfogle. And then part of the money was then taken by the insurance company and spread around to Met Council's friends in the form of campaign donations.
Do we know who those recipients were?
Well, you know, Shelley Silver was one of them. Chris Quinn was one of them. You know, a bunch of the people. Bill Thompson received money. A bunch of people who ran for mayor. You know, the Met Council received millions and millions of dollars in member item money, pork prop money, from both the legislature, state legislature, and the city council. Its lifeblood is government funding. So Rockfogle had this scheme, according to the investigators, which is Attorney General Eric Schneiderman's office and Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli's office.
And they found out by a letter, right? Somebody wrote him a letter.
There was a whistleblower to the Met Council, and then the Met Council forwarded it to Schneiderman. But it's been going on for two decades. And, you know, he had 400,000 stashed away in his houses.
Now I want to stop you
right there. A major player.
Now I want to stop you right there. So the investigators get a subpoena. They go into the house. They look in the closets and they find shoeboxes filled with cash, right?
More or less, yeah. They said that they found money and stuff in a bedroom closet in their New York City co-op. And then he also said, here's the money I had stashed away. He actually brought them the bulk of the $400,000.
And he admitted right away that he had made mistakes.
Yes, he put out an odd statement where he apologized, where he said he made mistakes, but he didn't really say what he was apologizing for. A lot of people think he's going to plead to something, obviously. Yeah. But what was also interesting was how quickly, well, without going into detail of his own crimes, possible crimes.
He apologized.
But how quickly he not only apologized, but had his lawyer put out a statement saying, and my wife, Judy Rapfogel, and Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver knew nothing about this.
Well, first of all, in my house, if I drop a quarter in a closet, you know, I say, Roselle, did you see that quarter? She's going to say, yeah, it's under the lip where you keep the shoes under the thing. So the idea that you had shoeboxes filled with money is hard to fathom, although who am I to say whether or not she just wasn't a good housekeeper and didn't see the money in the shoeboxes?
I mean, you don't know. You don't know. She says to her friends and people that she doesn't. She has not been, as of a week or two ago, she hadn't been questioned by investigators. She doesn't have a lawyer.
I want to stop you because I talked to a prosecutor about this one who said quite frequently, in order to get a guy to take a plea, you say, maybe it happened in the Madoff case, maybe not, we'll leave the wife out of this if you comply and take a plea.
And look, she's going to be the sole breadwinner. I mean, he's going to be in jail in all likelihood if he does plead guilty. And I think they want to protect the speaker, too. I mean, they're very close friends since Willie Rapfogel was 16 years old.
Yep.
Shelley Silver was his community basketball league coach. That's where they first met. They've been friends for a very long time. The thinking is, what does he know about the speaker? And what do we know? And will they look into, you know, did the people who received these donations know what was going on? Everyone says no, but will that be investigated?
Do you think, because I don't, I think Shelley Silver is one of the canniest, most facile players in the game. I have certain reservations about the fact that he takes a lot of money from the law firm he works for that wants to reform our tort reform system. But
it does not want to reform the tort reform.
Yeah, it does not want to. That's right. I don't see him as a guy who's a crook. I think he knows better than that. They go after him for things like taking an upgrade on a hotel room, you know, but that stuff doesn't stick. He's too smart for that. I have a feeling when he heard about Willie, he was really shocked.
That's what he says. Shocked and saddened. You know, don't know. I mean, the weird thing is, like, all these scandals keep happening, and Shelley Silver is on the periphery of all of them. You know, the Vito Lopez scandal, all these other issues. And, you know, they haven't gotten a smoking gun on him, certainly. And there's no evidence. I've not seen
Well,
any
Vito Lopez, who was Vito Gropez, as we say, yes. It was clear Shelley was protecting his members once again. Yes. That's different.
But Rapfogel has the potential. If anything was going to bring Shelley Silver down, it would be this scandal because of how close Rapfogel is, because of who his wife is, and what Rapfogel might know. You know, if Rapfogel decided to sing about anything he knew, if there is anything to sing about. And look, one of the stories, Newsday broke it, we followed it, was that when the assembly, several times, when the members got together to talk about where we're going to send our pork money, Judy Rapfogel sat in on the meeting as a representative of Sheldon Silver. Now, a lot of people who I've interviewed, lawmakers who were in those meetings, said not once did she ever say you should give to the Met Council. One person told me they specifically asked her, should we give to Met Council? She goes, I'm not going to tell you that, but I will tell you that whether you give or not give, it has no impact on the speaker. In other words, you're not being pressured. However, you know, seeing the chief of staff of the speaker, who's the wife of, and that you know is the wife of Met Council, you know, it's hard to believe, you know, when she's sitting in on these meetings, it's not in people's heads that I can curry favor with the speaker by sending my money that way.
Okay. Put yourself into Shelley Silver's head. Do you fire Judy Rapfogel now?
I think she's a political liability that's going to be there.
But remember, but she's been on every major political calculation this guy's ever made.
And I think, you know, she knows a lot of stuff, too. And also, the reality is, and we've seen this to a fault, you know, he doesn't have a lot of people who are very close to him. Right. But those who are, he's extremely loyal to. We saw it with Michael Boxley. We saw it with Bill Collins.
Michael Boxley, the accused rapist.
Yeah, twice. And, you know, the first time, Shelley Silver stuck by him, saying, yeah, we'll look into it, but I think he'll be exonerated. And then, you know, we saw it with Bill Collins, the counsel who was involved in a lot of these investigating and look into the sexual harassment within the assembly, who finally was forced to step down this year after another case came forward. So he sticks with people he feels comfortable with because he doesn't have a lot of people he feels comfortable with. So, you know, Judy Rapfogel, right now they're saying she's not going anywhere. Now, maybe she decides on her own.
Says, go, Judy, and we'll take care of you some other
way. Exactly. Because that has the potential to be a major liability for him.
Yeah, that's just a fascinating question. Let's talk about Cuomo and Bill de Blasio. This is unbelievable. So it now turns out that de Blasio, who most people didn't know a lot about and who the negative researchers did not get to in time for the primary, now has a little bit of background, Sandinista background, you know, other stuff that the papers have been dredging up. But also he's a progressive, and New York City voters are saying, we want a progressive now. We've had too much of the other guy.
He's up by 50 points. Yeah, they certainly want it.
Yeah. We don't want that, you know, the sort of Bloomberg tale of two cities. And so they take the guy. He's got an ethnically diverse family. He's New York.
Yeah.
He's very New York. Along comes Andrew Cuomo, who says, you know what? I'm not doing too good upstate. So what I want to do is go back to my original strategy and start hitting on the taxes are too high. Along comes de Blasio and says, no, we want to soak the rich in New York City. And there are a lot of people who think that this could be a major confrontation.
Absolutely. I think the governor is looking for ways to avoid it, but there's no doubt that the governor wants to cut taxes next year, and I don't see him wanting to raise taxes on the rich in New York City, which, by the way, is probably the place he's doing best in the polls right now.
Sure.
And I think it's going to be a major issue, tax cuts in the suburbs and upstate, as you said. And here comes Bill de Blasio, who wants to raise the personal income tax on those making $500,000 or more so he could fund pre-K and some other education programs. I have written a couple, probably 2 months ago, that it's a no-go in the legislature next year, that the governor is not going to want to do that, and that certainly the Republican Senate in an election year is not going to approve higher taxes on the rich. You know, that's their bread and butter. So I don't think that's going to happen. The governor has yet to take a position on the proposal, but I think he's going to seek a way to try and fund pre-K and these programs, probably by restoring AIM that had been cut for years, government funding for the city that he had cut years ago, probably restore that they can then have the money to fund these programs without raising taxes.
This could be a potential disaster for Cuomo, couldn't it? Because here's this very now up-and-coming and popular guy in New York City, as we are seeing, and Cuomo's been around a little while. He's had his trials and tribulations. His numbers went up, then they went down a little bit. They're down upstate. And why would he need a fight with de Blasio, of all people?
And, you know, the truth is, they do have a solid friendship. De Blasio worked for Cuomo and HUD. They do like each other. Where I think it's really going to hurt Cuomo is where he's weakest within the party, which is the progressive side of things.
Sure.
They don't trust him, the progressives. And if he has national ambitions, and look, you know, it doesn't look like he's going to run in 2016, but
he's still a young man.
But you never know. And he's going to have to win over a progressive wing of the party that dominates in Democratic primaries and really does not trust him.
Yeah. Well, okay. So one thing really quickly, and that's casinos. New York has to vote for them. There's a big hell of a fight going on. Right now, some of the polls are saying that people want them, or that by a narrow margin, at least they want them. Are we going to have casinos in New York?
I think, well, one way or the other, yeah, the fix is in on this one. Not only do you have all these groups that the governor put together, a coalition, that are going to put big money behind the effort to get this passed, but also, if the wording of the language, of the ballot language, is basically, do you support casinos because they would be amazing for economic development?
Yeah, yeah,
that's obviously not a direct quote, but that's the message. So that feeling is that, you know, that they're trying to tip it in the
Well, the governor's for it.
And then on top of that, even if it fails,
yeah,
they will create three new big video lottery parlors, these racinos.
Yeah, yeah.
So
they have one in Saratoga,
right? So even if you vote against expanding casino gambling,
yeah,
you're going to get expanded casino gambling.
Right.
And yeah, they have one in Saratoga. There's nine of them across the state.
We are talking to Ken Lovett. I have to tell you, I want to ask you a question real fast, Ken. Do you sleep well at night? Because, you know, when you take some of these characters on the way you are, it's got to be a little daunting. Even I, in my limited position, feel it every once in a while. How do you cope with that?
Look, you know, it's a good question. Look, it is daunting, but you feel if you're on the right side of things. I think I'm flexible enough. If someone makes an argument I buy, I'm not tied into my position that I will ignore it. But if I feel I'm right, I will dig in and I will report what I think's the truth.
Do your editors ever get worried? Do your people ever get
worried? No, to be honest with you, I've had really good editors who have really backed me up. And that's the only way you can do stuff like this. Because if you don't have the support at the top and they're not going to let you run with what you have, then there's no use in picking these fights.
Well, Ken Levitt, I admire you an awful lot. I want to tell you that, and I want to thank you for all you're doing for all of us, because information is central to democracy, and you're providing it. I appreciate it very much. Our guest has been columnist and Albany bureau chief for the New York Daily News, Ken Levitt. Ken, again, thank you for joining us, and we'll be seeing you, I'm sure, a lot more in the coming year.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org, and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decision to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.